tuning in to the second episode of the TCM Wire podcast. I'm your host, Calvin Moore, and my co-host, David Sidebottom, is on the line as well. Say hi, David.
Hello, guys. Good morning, good evening, whatever time you're listening. Hello, and happy, for us, post-inauguration day. Is it post-inauguration day yet?
It is post-inauguration day, which we'll get into in just a sec. But before we get into our roundtable discussion, this episode is going to feature music from the artist Jeremy Vanderloop. He is a worship leader. And it's also going to feature an interview with the artist that I conducted at the end of last year that we told them we would be posting this year. So that's going to be part of our podcast today. We really hope that you like what you hear. And in future podcasts, Kara Tipton has told me that she is coming back to do more of The Accomplice, or she'll be giving more advice and counsel to people who are sending her letters. She's kind of in the middle of, she just had a baby, and now she's in the middle of a huge move. So we've kind of given her some time off, but she should be back within the next few episodes of our show. But as of right now, we still kind of have just the interview and the reviews of music and the roundtable. So as of right now, as of press time, I have no idea what the review is going to be on Dual Impression. So it will surprise everyone just as much as it surprises me. But either way, let's talk a little bit about what we're going to talk about in our roundtable. We're going to be talking about this tweet that Pastor Mark Driscoll sent out. As of press time, Barack Obama has now taken office for the second time. He was inaugurated in a private ceremony on January 20th per the Constitution, and on January 21st, which was Martin Luther King Day, he took the public oath of office on the steps of the Capitol building. And he chose to take the oath of office with his hand on not just Washington's Bible, which has kind of been a tradition of many, many presidents, but also on Martin Luther King's Bible. And it was just kind of a interesting historical moment to take in. Obviously, this is the first African-American president. He's won two terms, won a hard-fought second election. And love him or hate him, he is the president of the United States. So prior to taking the oath of office, Pastor Mark Driscoll, who is a prominent evangelical megachurch pastor out on the West Coast, he tweeted these words. He said, "Praying for our president, who today will place his hand on a Bible he does not believe, to take an oath to a God he likely does not know." And this, of course, understandably, this caused quite a firestorm. I mean, many other prominent pastors ridiculed Driscoll's words, and others defended his words. Some said it was horrendous. Some said this is him speaking prophetically. And so we're going to discuss that today. But before we discuss it, I want to introduce our panelists. Obviously, my co-host David is on the line. And then one of our usual suspects, Justin Imers, is on the line. What's up, Justin?
Hey, how you doing?
Glad to have you back. Always glad to have your voice on our podcast. And then we kind of have a new voice to the podcast. We have Ian Ebright. I'm pronouncing your last name correctly, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Ian Ebright is joining us, and Ian is the primary writer for the blog, the Broken Telegraph. Ian, talk a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
Sure. So I'm a blogger from my site, The Broken Telegraph. I've been writing there for coming up on 5 years. My co-writer is Tiffany Lucas, and we focus in on faith, life, culture, and human rights. And both of our backgrounds, Tiffany and myself, are people who we've been in the church since we basically as long as we know. We're both in the Seattle area, have sort of church hops, so we've seen the good and the bad that church is capable of, and we write from sort of an ex-fundamentalist perspective, trying to esteem Christ and point to the gospel in direct and indirect ways, while also challenging what we see as an abuse of faith and power at times. I also write for Relevant Magazine, and I'm a frequent contributor for that site, as well as Tony Campolo's Red Letter Christians. And then I'm working on some film projects on the site as well.
Okay, so you're on the left coast over there. You're actually out where Pastor Mark Driscoll pastors. He's out in Seattle, right?
Exactly, and I'll set the table by saying I used to be a Mars Hill attendee, and I won't, I'm not going to name the person, but have served in different capacities with people who are now other Mars Hill pastors, and know some people who go to Mars Hill and think highly of them. So I, you know, I was not only not a member of the church, but was an attendee for anywhere from 6 months to a year a few years back, but continue to know people. I mean, Seattle is actually more of a small town than people realize, but know a lot of people who go there or a lot of people who have left, and yeah, and have sort of an insider's view of that church, and then obviously an outsider's view having left.
Okay, all right, cool. Well, let's kind of talk then about, I mean, obviously you're going to have more of an insider and outsider perspective, living out in that area, interacting with and having a relationship with people who are part of Driscoll's church. I guess the question we want to consider tonight, we want to consider a few questions, but obviously this tweet went out again, praying for our president who today will place his hand on a Bible he does not believe to take an oath to a God he likely does not know. I'm still kind of on the fence as to what I think, so maybe talking this out with you guys is going to help me come to terms with what I do think. I've been a kind of an unabashed fan of Driscoll's in the past and kind of go back and forth as to what I think. But the first question I want to ask is, in today's world of social networking and the 24/7 news cycle, how far should a pastor go when attempting to speak prophetically? Because when I look at, you know, the commentary that's gone back and forth on his Facebook and on his Twitter, I mean, it's been retweeted thousands of times, and he's had over 10,000 comments on his Facebook page. You know, some favorable, some not favorable. But some are saying he's speaking prophetically, and we'll get into that in just a minute. But in today's day and age, how far should a pastor go when they're attempting to speak that way? And anybody can start off answering that question.
I actually think before we start off on too many answers there, we may want to clarify for our listeners who may not understand how we're using the word prophetically in this. And actually, I being one of those, when you say prophetically, do you mean to imply in some way prophesying, or is there another sense which that word is being used here?
The way that I'm using it, Al, okay, that's a very good thing to ask. The way that I'm using it actually has to do with the studies that I'm going through right now. We're actually in my master's program, we're studying the prophets and what it means to speak prophetically versus kind of this modern day notion of saying only good things about the church. Generally, prophets were speaking unfavorably about things, about the nation, about the king, about the people of God. So obviously we're not in the Old Testament or anything, but even Jesus was a prophet. So a pastor is saying harsh things that are not going to be popular, but that I guess I'm going to use this word very loosely because a lot of people don't have the same definition for it. Speaking biblically in regards to a particular person, place, thing, issue, matter, all those kinds of things. So that's what I mean when I talk about speaking prophetically. That's kind of our working definition here, not predicting the future, but speaking, I guess, harshly about people, places, and things as being opposed to God. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. That helps clarify it for me. Ian, you probably would have a pretty unique perspective given your background. What do you think about that prompt?
I mean, it's my feeling that, I mean, as someone who didn't vote for Obama, I'll just be honest and admit that I voted third party, and I throw that out to say, like, my dog in this fight is not partisan. And so I would count myself among those who challenge Obama. And I would say the same of a lot of our politicians on the right. I'm, I guess, an independent voter. My reason, or my feeling about why it went too far is, and this is a distinction that really worries me that more people don't see, is he's crossed over from criticizing behavior or policy or public statements, which are all sort of tangible things that end up in the marketplace of ideas that we're free to either agree with or disagree with and then are allowed to wrestle with. He's crossed over out of that plane into the area of the personal, which he just doesn't have room to speak because, you know, I know he uses a couple words in there that sort of are his get out of jail free card in that tweet. And I know that word likely buys him some grace, because he's not deciding that Obama doesn't know God, but he's all but implying that Obama doesn't know God. And for those of us who know Driscoll's theology, it's very inclusivist and very strong that, you know, if there is one way, and if Christ isn't plugged into that, then you're facing the fires of hell. And I don't want to get off on a sidetrack there, but for me, that's why he's gone too far. And to answer your question, Calvin, because it's not a prophetic, it's not a criticism that addresses, you know, things that are legitimate things to discuss, policy or public statements. I mean, he's just saying, hey, you, person I don't know, you don't believe in the Bible, and, you know, your eternal state is not looking good. I mean, and for me, that's a really, really troubling bridge to cross, and I'm appalled that more people, including people who support Driscoll's ministry, won't call him out and say, like, there's a really large arena that already exists for those of us in the church to work out of as we speak prophetically to those in power, you know, and why he would go outside of that really large arena to speak into the personal is, I don't know. I mean, I use the word, I just found the tweet to be really bigoted, and I don't want to go as far as to call him a bigot, but to me it was incredibly judgmental and simplistic for him to, you know, it's funny, in my time at Mars Hill, and some of the people that I respect that go there, I mean, one of the books that they often cite is Knowing God by J.I. Packer, and he has this great passage in there talking about how none of us should ever be so egotistical as to conclude that we've been invited into God's control tower. And the if I remember correctly, the word picture that he paints is something like, you know, a tower overlooking trains that are coming and going, and really having the sense of the details of God's inner workings. And I think that really applies here. Like, you know, this relationship with God, or this union with God, or whatever we have when we enter into forgiveness and reconciliation with Christ, does not invite us to sort of the inner workings of, in this case, I mean, people's hearts and sort of their present eternal status. And so we can certainly feel touched by God and moved by God. We can respond to his will. I mean, there's different ways for us to interact. I think we have to tread really lightly when we make any sort of definitive statements. And to the person that would respond about Christ's harsh use of language, including calling people vipers and things, I would say, again, that's a huge distinction that Christ certainly characterized, and we also have to note that Christ was perfect and probably knew things that Driscoll and the rest of us didn't, but I see Christ calling out a lot of behavior and certainly speaking about the fires of hell, but I don't see anywhere in there where he invites those of us who are the church to go a step further and decide about the condition of the heart. And for me, that's why that tweet was so inflammatory and absurd.
Yeah, Josh, do you want to weigh in? Do you want to find that?
I think that's interesting, Ian. I mean, I'll push back a little, and then I want to know what Justin's perspective is on this. There's that point where Jesus does go and say, "You're a brood of vipers." Of course, I was like, wow, I mean, that's pretty in your face. I don't think anybody was like, hey, you know what? You know what I would love to be called today? I would love to be called a brood of vipers. I mean, that just doesn't seem, that to me seems like in your face, calling people out. And I mean, he does call out their behavior as well, but then he also says this about them. But I do want to know Justin's perspective as well, because Justin, give your perspective. I'm not going to speak for you. I want to know what you think on this.
Well, I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that Pastor Mark said it. Mark is a very polarizing Christian voice in the American Christian scene. And if these words had been written down by someone like a John Piper or a Francis Chan, I don't think you would see the outrage as much, because they think that Mark is flippant. And I think sometimes they're right. I think sometimes he goes out of his way almost to be controversial for no good reason. I don't know if I necessarily agree with him, although I kind of get where he's going with it. There's an issue for a lot of Christians, including myself, and I think Mark would kind of put himself in this, that believe that something like a scripture to be sworn upon in the secular arena, in the culture that we live in today, is getting to a point to where it's kind of inappropriate, especially for an individual whose policies are a little bit more anti-Christian than some presidents that we've had in the past. So I think he sees an irony there, and he decided to speak into that issue. I don't know if I'm a fan of him necessarily making a declaration of where Obama sits in terms of whether or not he is a part of God's people or not. I think that's between Barack and God, to be frank. But I understand what you're saying, Kelvin, with, you know, Jesus making statements about people, but we also have to remember who Jesus made those statements about. And those were always, without an exception to the rule, the religious hypocrites. So if anything, Jesus is saying those sorts of things to other Christians.
Now, gotcha. Now, here's the thing. Here's where I would push back on that, is that Barack Obama has said, I am a Christian. And he has emphatically said that because, you know, a lot of people think that he's a Muslim. So he stated over and over and over and over and over again, I am a Christian, I am a Christian, I am a Christian, I am a Christian. And so Driscoll is saying, well, if you're saying a Christian, you're a Christian, here are the things that you are voting for, here are the policies that you're putting out that are antithetical to what Scripture is saying. So here's now Driscoll saying, he probably doesn't really believe this, because if he did, he wouldn't be voting this way. And that's what a lot of people are saying. So, but then again, you know,
you can say the same thing about anything, though. I mean, the issue is that on either side of the party, you've got people voting for things that are anti-biblical. So to be honest, if you're a politician in this country and you're voting along party lines, either Republican or Democrat, you are violating biblical principle. It doesn't matter which side you're on. You're violating biblical principle on both sides. So your hands cannot keep from being clean. That's one of the issues with politics in this country. But the religious, yes, he's stating that he's a Christian, but he's not a Christian leader. And who did Christ really criticize? Criticizing the religious elite, right? I mean, he was criticizing the religious leaders, the Pharisees. These are men who've devoted their lives to the law and devoted their lives to temple sacrifice and worship. And they're the aristocracy of the priesthood. So that is who he pushes back against. He's not pushing back against the everyday Jew. He's pushing back against the elite. We've got to be careful about drawing a parallel between when Christ got a little in your face and this particular instance. I don't see how you can connect the two, because they're just not. They're similar, but they're not similar enough to where it could really justify what he did.
Yeah, I mean, I think the medium he chose to make his comment is really crude and absurd. I mean, if he wants to write a post and outline why he feels that Obama's policy positions don't align with Christian faith, I mean, then that's closer to the area of thoughtful discourse. But, you know, to leave all of that out, I mean, the thing that we forget, I mean, one of the issues that we know is like the elephant in the room is obviously abortion. And, you know, we have to remember that under all of the Republicans from Reagan to Bush 1 and Bush 2, you know, 8 years of Bush 2 or W, you know, with the exception of W outlawing late-term abortions, abortions have not vanished from the country. I mean, and you've heard it reported that a lot of these people within the GOP say, you know, I don't know what to tell you, but it's the law of the land. Like, I think it was one of the conservative Supreme Court justices who said that. Might have been Roberts, but it was basically like throwing their hands up, like, I hear you, but this is the law of the land. Like, I don't know what to tell you. So the weird sort of lopsided vitriol that gets thrown at Obama about abortion, to me, is a really selective tunnel vision, because it sort of ignores the fact that we've seen very little progress. And I'll give Bush credit for the late-term legislation that happened under his watch, but aside from that, like, abortion continues. So it's a weird level of sort of tunnel-sided or tunnel-vision vitriol that we aim at Obama about this issue of abortion.
We are getting a little bit off-topic once we start. I mean, that's certainly, I think, a valid point. There is quite likely tunnel vision involved in this, but I once we start bringing up, Bush, if this was said of Bush, would it have been okay? Would it have been not okay? Is it standard? I don't know if that really has to do with the prompt of how far should someone go when attempting to speak prophetically, specifically in reference to Driscoll's,
statement. But you're saying that that you have an issue with his statement, and yet his statement's politically motivated. And I'm saying there's only a couple of issues.
I don't have an issue with his statement at all. Calvin, it might have been you made the point. It was probably Justin. But if this were not Mark Driscoll saying this, without the framework of the way he treats people such as Rob Bell and such like that, simply the statement, praying for the president who will today place his hand in the Bible, he does not believe to take an oath that he probably likely does not know. That doesn't have to come across as criticism, truthfully. I think it's fairly obvious that Obama is secular and no criticism in any sort of personal sense, but I don't consider him to be the same sort of believer as you guys. And if there is something to taking an oath, then a man who's taking an oath by a God he doesn't understand, even if he believes in it, not understanding it, that's not bad. And certainly that merits prayer. That requires reading into his personal life, the sort of thing which you're accusing him of reading into Obama's.
The tweet was a God that he likely doesn't know. So what he's really saying, he's placing Obama outside of the love and the relationship with God. Am I understanding you correctly that you're saying that's in bounds? That's something as Christians we should be allowed to declare about another person that's 3,500 miles away from us, that based on what we know of them, we have the right to all but conclude about their eternal state?
What I'm saying is that you're reading into that hatefulness, which does not, if it were not for an assumption about Mark Driscoll's character, and bearing in mind, I should clarify this, I do not like Mark Driscoll a little tiny bit, and I will criticize him till I'm blue in the face, hundreds of things, but this is not one of them. This is not inherently hateful. Whenever we're arguing with people, people like to bring up, you're a theistic evolutionist, well, you're a this, well, you're a that. And I'll always just remind them, yes, I think those things, but that's not what I'm arguing right now. And so, yes, I may be vitriolic, but that is not what I'm saying right now. You can't criticize a major figure like Obama or like Driscoll for what he may or may not think or may not believe and be logically consistent about. Now, is this logically coherent? No. I don't expect logical coherency from Driscoll. Is this belligerent and obtuse by nature? No, it's not belligerent or obtuse. May it be in actuality? I'm not going to make that judgment call. And then in terms of has he crossed the line speaking prophetically here, in his maybe, but in terms of his actual words, he's praying for someone. Prayer by nature should not be an act of vitriol. And I would say that we should extend him some form of grace. In fact, I'll extend him some form of grace, disliking most points of his doctrine that,
Okay, let me jump in here for a second. One, I think that what Ian was saying is actually connected. Even though it was kind of going off a rabbit trail, I think it was very connected to the whole thing, especially when we talked about abortion. But we'll bring it back to the prophetic thing. I think when you're talking about Driscoll, what he said is, I'm praying for the president, okay? And that's the other part of this that's the get-out-of-jail-free card for me. Like, oh, I'm praying for the president. Well, that's a good thing. We're Christians. We're supposed to pray for the president, blah, blah, blah. Pray for your leaders. But then he says that thing. Okay, but he doesn't really believe in God. He doesn't likely believe in God. And I really agree with Ian there. But the original question really is prophetic. Is he speaking prophetically? And Ian, to answer your question, can you talk about someone's faith who's 3,500 miles away? I think that you can, based on scripture saying, you'll know a tree by its fruit. Now I can go, you can go back and forth as to, okay, does that person need to be in your life? Do you need to see their fruit on a day-to-day basis? Yada yada yada. You can do that. But I do think that you can judge from miles away, as Paul did so by someone just telling him, hey, this is what's going on in Corinth, and then Paul writes to them and says, what? I'm passing judgment on this already. Expel that dude from your congregation. That's wrong. Why are you even asking me about this? So I think that that's That's something that can be done. How do we do it in our new day and age? I'm not sure, which is what the whole question was getting at. But the next question I want to get into, just kind of bring it back to where we are, is, or what we're trying to get at, is, were Driscoll's words an abuse of a powerful platform? Because this is a guy who people know. He is in this social networking world. He's been on, you know, ABC and had these debates and stuff, and he's invited to all these conferences and out to all these colleges to speak and all these different things. So he's got thousands of people following on Facebook and Twitter, and enough to the point that we're actually talking about him, right? We don't know this guy, but we're talking about him. So were his words an abuse of a powerful platform, i.e. is he using it as a bully pulpit, or was he doing what pastors are called to do? Agree or disagree, did he get this prophet, you know, this prophetic speaking wrong? Was he using his platform correctly or incorrectly? That's really what I want to get at in this next question here.
I would say that as we move out of our circles of familiarity and into national discourse, that at the very least the New Testament would tell us to have a sensitivity and to temper ourselves, really to be rooted in humility, understanding that human beings are incredibly complex, and especially these political offices are incredibly morally complex, and that as we move away from the familiar of our immediate community, we have to engage in whatever prophetic speech we want to say with an increasing level of awareness for the complexity and the unknown that's beyond us. And what I mean by that is not in general in the universe, but I mean the variables impacting the people beyond our immediate community that we don't know exist. And I would say if that wasn't an abuse of his position, I don't know what is. Like, I don't know how you go lower than saying that guy I disagree with. I mean, what is more to the core of a human being than a man who's president who claims to be a follower of Christ, for someone to then respond, I likely or I highly doubt that's true. I mean, I guess I don't know how much further we can go. If that's not abuse of power, I mean, what's possibly more personal, more at the core, and more raw, and more of an indictment of an individual than to question someone's own eternity and relationship with God? Like, I honestly don't know how much further we could go, and you know, if that makes
now,
sense.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Question is, can we do that? I know we do. I mean, Alyssa Milano, who was on Who's the Boss? I'm dating myself here. She, I guess, tweeted back to Driscoll saying that, you know, aren't we supposed to be about love and peace, and that's what Christians are about? And I'm like, okay, if non-Christians are now telling us what the gospel is supposed to be about, I have a question. And when I do look at scripture, I get to those texts about love and loving your neighbor and taking care of the poor and the marginalized and the downtrodden, those are who are on the edges of society. I see all of that, but I also see, you know, where it talks about, you know, removing the plank from your own eye so that you can judge rightly, not so that you can't judge. That's not all scripture about not judging at all. It's, hey, remove what's in your own eye so that you can rightly judge, so that you can call an ace and a spade. And I think
right.
In this instance, I'm like, is that what he's doing here? Or is he just being a bully and saying you're not really a Christian because you don't vote as I vote?
So that word judge, I think, like, would need to be unpacked, because that can include, you know, rightful accountability between members of a church or members of the faith that know each other. I mean, judge can also be sort of misplaced condemnation about someone's eternal destination. I mean, that's the problem, is that we have this word judge that some people are using to say, well, I see examples of accountability in Paul's letters, and then they're using the same word judge to say, well, that gives me the license to all but conclude about someone's eternal destination or the fact that they think the Bible's a joke. I mean, we really need to sort of, like, define our terms here. I think one form of judge is really more about accountability and the fact that we all in some way more or less agree to standards based on the Bible, and obviously we have a dialogue about our differences. The other is more of the judgment that's rightly left in God's hands, which is deciding, you know, making or strongly implying about the eternal state of someone's soul. I mean, I don't see anywhere in the Bible where we are told to go wandering in that wilderness. Judgment for me in the New Testament is always limited to characterizing behavior accountability, all within the context of returning somebody to the church body, not to cast somebody out, and certainly not to make a decision about their eternal state. So judge, yes, but I would choose different words. I would use judge when it comes to eternal condemnation and say that's not for us, that's for God. And I would say the type of judging that's more of accountability or discipline, yes, we have that based on our mutuality in Scripture. And if Driscoll wanted to be that specific in different instances, I'm sure I would be less troubled by it.
You know, just like I'm not ready to go out of my way to say that what he did was right, I'm also not out of my way to say that it was an abuse of power. I think that Driscoll is a man who speaks from his heart and from his gut. And while there are a lot of people who aren't going to agree with him, I think there is, in this 21st century American culture that we live in, a necessity for accountability. And Obama has come out and said some pretty negative things, although claiming to be a Christian, about the Bible and about the church.
I think that's too big of a statement for you to make without giving examples.
Well, it's not too big of a statement. He stated it himself. I mean, he stated himself that the Bible isn't true. In a speech that he made in his first election in 2008, in Illinois, I do believe, and I do believe he made another statement to that fact in Connecticut during that same election year. So, I mean, we have to take what he says for himself into account when we make the when we discuss the topic. There are so many churches and so many denominations and so many different theological outlooks. How do we hold anyone accountable for what they say and what they do in the church if we aren't allowed to draw lines? And I think that Jesus said to Peter, what you bind on earth is bound in heaven, and what you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. And I know I'm using a very Roman Catholic interpretation of that, but I really don't have any other way to read it. Mark is a leader in the church. Whether you agree with whether he should be or not really isn't an issue. He is a leader in the church, and so I think that God has placed him there, and if he's made a statement, I think on some level we need to, while holding him accountable, at the same time show a sense of respect for where God has put him. I think people are so drastically accusatory towards Mark, just like people are with Obama.
Well, here's what I have. Here's what I have difficulty with.
There's about a thousand things in there.
Yeah, here's what I have difficulty with. And I would want to know specifically where he said those things, but. In this day and age, pastors, period, and I hate the fact that, you know, our culture does have to contextualize a little bit of how we say and do things. I look at Driscoll's Facebook post now, okay, and there's over 10,000 responses, okay? So we've got a pastor saying something with a national platform. Okay, if he's speaking prophetically, he's speaking prophetically. We haven't determined whether he is or not. I don't think we really can. But maybe the conversation is kind of a red herring to begin with. But he says these things. He's got over 10,000 comments, thousands of retweets, thousands of responses on Twitter as well. And he's causing all sorts of division within the church and outside the church, and giving people ammunition, and maybe I don't care as much about people who are outside the church having more ammunition against the church, because scoffers are always going to scoff. I do have that very evangelical outlook about not catering to unbelievers and changing everything to make everything palatable, but I do see Christians now eviscerating other Christians because this pastor, who has been entrusted by a lot of people because of his video ministry and speaking at different places and all those kinds of things, I do find that maybe the way that he went about this was a bad way of going about this. Maybe he could have said something like praying for our president and left it at that. And you know what? Whether you agree with the president or not, that's going to cause, you know, people who are upset about him praying for the president. But it's never wrong to pray for someone you disagree with. Could he have said something else that left the president out? I don't know. But I do feel like, in a way, he really went about this wrong. Even if he thought he was speaking prophetically, even if people were defending him as speaking prophetically, I feel like this particular instance, as much as I love you, Mark, and you can disagree with me if you're even going to listen to our little podcast here, I feel like he got it wrong. I feel like he went about this wrong. Was his heart maybe in the right place? I hope so. I don't want to assume, like he has done, that his heart was in the wrong place, but it just seems to me like there was another way to go about doing this that would not have divided the body in such a way as it is divided. And now, okay, and again, 2 weeks, nobody will even think about this, but I do think that what he has done in the here and the now has been more divisive and more wrong, and in a sense, very sinful. Very sinful. I guess I'll just leave it at that.
I would say to the previous comment, I certainly don't subscribe to the idea that God has placed every pastor. We've seen several pastors fall out of the limelight for getting into scandal, and obviously we don't comment on their status before God, but I think a lot of people find their way into ministry that are not equipped for ministry as a general rule of thumb. And I would also disagree with you, Calvin, and my feeling is that we need to listen more to those outside the church, that often our responsibility as people who are trying to reflect the light of Christ often obscure and confuse the gospel so much that we drive people away. And I think we have a really great responsibility to those outside the church to be a redemptive presence. And yes, at times a difficult countercultural presence, but ultimately that we're drawing people to the love of Christ. And then on the flip side of that coin, we have the ability to drive people away. And
I guess what I'm getting at there, and I'll just speak on this briefly because we do need to get to the third question, but what I mean there is I find the church often apologizing for all manner of things that people have no idea what they're talking about. Like, oh, what about the Crusades? Well, which crusade are you talking about? I'm a history major. So I'm like, okay, do you know that there were like 11 Crusades? Which one are you referring to? Or do you just want to make an excuse for why you don't want to go to church or be accountable to anybody? That is one thing. But if the church is actually hurt you, or somebody in the church has hurt you personally, that's another thing. But do we change the gospel and apologize for all manner of craziness in order to make, you know, unsaved people feel comfortable enough to walk through our doors? I don't believe we should do that. Should the church apologize for what it's done wrong? Yes. Should the church, go outside of its doors and not make its own, culture unto itself that excludes those outside of the church? Yes, they should do those things. But should we make the gospel more palatable? Should we make the gospel less of an offense? No. Should we be less offensive as people? Absolutely. That's really what I'm getting at there.
Yeah.
So I wasn't trying to say, hey, you know what? Let's just not care what unsaved people think at all. I'm not of that belief at all. I'm, huge fan of David Kinnaman's book, Unchristian and Lost, and looking at, what people really think outside of the church about us. I love those kinds of dialogues. That's really, I wanted to clarify what I meant.
Sure. I think it's really odd. I think I might be probably, I want to clarify, I'm not like, not rapidly against him. I'll usually try to be gracious wherever I can, but I think the ironic thing is I think probably being the most adamant, not Driscoll fan, I won't say anti-Driscoll, but I've been very, very disenthused with some of his public behavior the past few years, and that's how I came to be not a fan, is because of things which I think very much are akin to Ian and Justin, exactly what you guys are describing, which would be problematic behaviors. But kind of in the grand light of some of the things which a lot of evangelicals said about even other evangelicals, Rob Bell comes to mind, that this is like a minor slight coming from Mark Driscoll. I mean, he didn't call anyone a girly man this time, and he didn't insinuate that anyone's denomination was completely feminine, and somehow that's an insult. I think hearing a lot of people say things like, Ian, you brought up a good point, how deep a wound does it cut if if you're questioning someone's faith, you know, there is that. But on the other hand, I think that there is a sense where, you know, did he abuse his power? No, he used his power to say the things which he believes. Now the question is the church as a corporate entity abusing its position in the culture by having pastors like Mark Driscoll? And I would say that that would be something I'd be more concerned about. I think that this is, if Mark Driscoll is a good pastor, then this is just kind of what comes with his whole shebang, is that he says publicly controversial things. You know, he's got 10,000 comments, and that's great for his church. It's not
now,
necessarily so great for the rest of America.
I mean, that's one thing that's one thing I want to challenge from a comment that was said earlier, was the implication that Mark sort of speaks off the cuff and he's, you know, he does what he does. And I would say, you know, that almost, we're almost insulating him from criticism by allowing him to act in any way that he sees fit. I mean, I would say what's driving his comments. And like Calvin has been good to say, like, I don't know Driscoll's heart, like that's between him and God. But like, we should at least consider that there's a possibility that ego and narcissism and hubris can be at work, just as conviction and biblical insight and some prophetic voice can be at work. I mean, to sort of assume that what's guiding every sort of whim and tweet and reaction that he has is only positive insulates him from criticism and sort of creates this atmosphere where he can continue to perpetuate this damage. And I really do believe, as a former Mars Hill guy myself, but more importantly, based on the stories I've heard from other people who have been driven from the church, I want to underscore that again. These kind of blanket statements that we say, which is not, I disagree with your policy, or I'm troubled by this specific act in your life as a fellow brother in Christ, but to go as far as to say, you are likely not the same believer that I am. That's the exact kind of stuff that drives people away. And I'm not so sure that God's going to – I'm not so sure it's going to be all come out in a wash, you know, when we face God someday. Let me be careful to not then judge him. What I'm saying specifically is I think we have a lot of responsibility, each of us individually, whether we're congregants or pastors, on how we steward our tongue and the kind of conclusions we make about people. And it has a huge impact, not just on our lives, but in the lives of the church body and the broader culture.
Now, I think that brings us to our last question. The reason I invited, for those who are listening, the reason I invited Ian on, as I've been, you know, checking out his blog for a while, The Broken Telegraph, you should definitely check it out. We'll have a link to it at the bottom of this podcast. Just a very thoughtful guy. But today on your Facebook, Ian, I saw that you had posted a video by Dr. Cornel West, African-American scholar, discussing why he did not like the idea of Obama using Martin Luther King's Bible to be sworn in. Now, Mark Driscoll used less than 140 characters to say what he wanted to say, right? And caused all this controversy. And Dr. Cornel West, also a well-known figure, also has a Twitter account, also has a Facebook account, but he had a forum, and he was sitting on the same forum with, I believe, Newt Gingrich was on the stage, if I'm not mistaken, and Tavis Smiley was hosting this. And and he explained in detail for about 5 or 6 minutes why he had a problem with this. And in the end, I don't think his words are uncontroversial. I'm sure that there are plenty of people who would disagree with what he had to say. But what he did say was said in such a manner and in such a forum that thoughtful dialogue is created out of it. And so my question now is, we're dealing with this. We're having this forum where we're discussing Mark Driscoll and whether this was prophetic or whether this was abusive. What responsibility do those with their own platforms? Again, we have a blog. People have radio shows, all these different things. What responsibility do those with their own platforms have to respond to abusive speech by other pastors? That's the final question I want to kind of consider here.
Do you mind if I take the opportunity to go ahead and spearhead that question a little bit?
Sure.
I mean, I just kind of have one thing to weigh in, which is, you know, you brought up Dr. Cornel, and sort of a shout out to him. I watched that, and if anyone hasn't watched it, it's worth every bit of just the 5 minutes which it is. As a speech, it was incredible. And what's more incredible, and especially in deference to how we should respond to people talking like Driscoll, and sort of the way I respond, which is And I quote this to make the point, and I don't mean this to claim anything about the nature of his character, but don't answer fool according to his folly, lest he think himself wise. Point of it being is not that Driscoll's a fool, but to say that if you take something which is foolish, and because it's foolish, give it airtime and give it attention and comment on it and share it, as compared to taking something like Dr. Carroll's speech, I believe that was his name, which was outstanding, fundamentally, the insight, whether it's wise or no, which he had in that 5-minute speech, is not going to get as widely spread as Mark Driscoll, because it's so much easier to focus on a 140-character negative tweet than on a 5-minute thoughtful speech.
But, I mean, here's a couple of distinctions that are important, because I agree that what Cornel West said was incredible, and a couple of important distinctions is for me, has nothing to do with the 140 characters versus the 5 minutes. One big one is the fact that Cornel West is a supporter of Obama. He's open for him. And we have to understand contextually that, you know, when we are criticizing sort of, quote unquote, a member of our own team, we have more leniency to do so. So Cornel West is in a position to be passionate and eloquent because he is a supporter of Obama, but he's concerned. And Driscoll is by no means known as as a supporter of Obama. Most people conclude, whether they're right or wrong, that he's a conservative guy espousing conservative theology. And so he then has to take that context into his criticism of Obama and have, again, not that he can't be firm or clear, but have a bit of sensitivity and in acknowledging that he's taking a shot across the field at the other team. And that's something that Driscoll did not do. The other biggest distinction, of course, is Cornel West is talking about issues. He's talking about drone strikes and the prison industrial complex and poverty. He's addressing Obama as a human being, but in the realm of issues. While Driscoll's greatest offense to most of us is that he's not addressing Obama in terms of issues. He's addressing Obama in terms of a person, specifically at the core, at his soul level, and doubting those things in terms of judgment or however you want to put it. So for me, that would wrap back around to answer your question, Calvin, which is those of us who have a platform on any level, when we engage, we should be issue-oriented. I mean, we're certainly going to take people on by the nature of the discourse, but we should ultimately be discussing issues and not the inner content of someone's soul. And to me, that's the big distinction between Driscoll's tweet and Cornel West's video, and why one is really eloquent and the other seems like he took a huge, you know, mallet to the guy.
Right. It's almost a theological version of a conversation descending into, you know, starting off. It's like a husband and wife starting off talking about the checkbook. Why aren't things balancing? To you're just like your father, and I hate your guts, and you're fat and you're ugly. It's a theological version of that, where Driscoll has done that, and you know, Cornel West has said, here's why the checkbook is not balancing. We forgot to move the decimal. We didn't carry the one. So right. I think what you said there, Ian, is spot on. I'm gonna agree with you. I'm gonna agree with you 100% there. We do need to wind down. I do want to get Justin's perspective though on this. What do you think, Justin? Hello.
I love the video. Video was fantastic, and I wish that. I'm going to say that I disagree with the way that Mark did it in the terms that it was on Twitter. He could have and should have, as Ian suggested earlier, probably done it in a blog where he explained himself a little bit. Because this just leaves too much room for things to be questioned, including intention. But I also think Ian's right in the sense that The reason why Dr. Cornel West probably got away with it is because he's playing on the same team, so that gives him a little leniency. But he's also dealing with an issue, not with a person. So you're going to get considerable leeway when you do it that way, versus when you actually make a judgment call on an individual's character. So
all right.
That's just
fair enough.
Kind of what I think about it.
Okay. Well, this conversation has gone really long, so we're going to wind down. For those of you who are listening, obviously, did you want to say something, David?
I said my piece. I think the only thing is I think I'd like to clarify, I'd reemphasize, I think we just need to focus on what's good, not what's bad. You know, deal with these bad prophetic speeches by listening to people like Dr. Cornell.
Okay.
I would very quickly add to that I think not just those inside the church, but those outside, you know, we all have this inherent hunger and thirst for righteousness. And sometimes people want us to step up and, you know, correct the wrongs that have occurred from people like Driscoll and others when they say these careless things. And in doing so, I think we bring about glimpses of God's kingdom. So sometimes that is the way that we get back to that right, is sort of correcting the trajectory to call a spade a spade.
Okay,
yep.
Cool. Well, for those of you who are listening, thanks so much for listening. And we want to know what your thoughts are. Was this prophetic speech or was this abusive speech? And what role do we have, if any, in correcting this kind of speech if we have any type of platform from which we can, I guess, kind of sound the alarm? So thanks so much for listening. We've got dual impressions coming up. And again, I have no idea what the dual impression segment is, but enjoy this review by Nick and James. And we will see you on the flip side. Talk to you later.
Welcome to daylight. Open your eyes for the very first time.
Hey everyone, welcome to Dual Impressions. My name is James Arnold. I've got Nick with me. Say hi, Nick.
Hi, Nick.
Yay! I'm glad when Nick is here. Just pretty frequent, as in every week. So, Nick and I are here to talk about Luminate's album. It's called Welcome to Daylight. I don't actually know when this album came out. It says 2012, so it's been out at least for a month. But I think it was late 2012. It was a decent little pop rock CCM album. It's, if you've ever listened to your local Christian radio station, The Fish, if you're in Southern California like we are, or I don't really know where any of the other ones are. But if you listen to anything like that, you can listen to The Fish online, actually. So maybe you have heard of it. This is the sort of stuff you're going to hear. This is sort of the mainstream of Christian music right now. And we're going to talk about it. So the album is Welcome to Daylight. The artist is Luminate. It's 11 tracks long. And what did you think of it, Nick?
It wasn't bad by any stretch, but I'm really struggling right now to remember which songs I actually liked.
Okay.
That feels really weird, so I should qualify. I listened to it twice while at work, and I can pay attention to music and do other things, so I'd like to think I can multitask pretty well. But after listening to it, I don't remember any of the songs except one. Okay, cool, my notes are up there, they are. Hi, notes. Okay. it's by no stretch a bad album. Like you said, it's something you'll hear, a decent little pop or CCM kind of stuff, but what track stood out to you the most? Because I have two written down here, and I'm curious to hear what yours are.
Yeah, so I think the tracks that stood out to me most are, let's see, Banner of Love, Heal This Home, and Living in a Memory. Those are the three that I enjoyed the most. But the whole album, like, has a little bit of a Fall Out Boy feel to it. Did you get that? Just
a little bit of Fall Out Boy. I got more of a U2.
Yeah. There's a little bit of that thrown in there, too. So if that's sort of the alley you enjoy listening to, this might be worth checking out. But I think those three tracks are the ones that stood out most to me. But overall, I mean, the album it's consistent. I will definitely give it that. It's very consistent throughout. To the point of, if you're not paying very close attention, a lot, you're not going to be able to tell when the song switches to the next one.
Yeah, that was a bit of a problem for me. This is interesting. We're going to illustrate the diversity of opinions on CCM / worship music / pop rock. The three songs you mentioned, I actually didn't like that much.
Really? What are the ones you liked?
Yeah. I liked... Never Give Up, just because I like the intro to the song, and it sounds like the band was actually getting some bangs going, you know? With it.
Yeah.
And I kind of like Welcome to Daylight, the opening, just because it sounds like Where the Streets Are No Name, the riff from U2.
Oh, okay.
So I liked that. And Love Is Left, I think, was highly energetic. So that was kind of a nice change of pace. I think I agree with you. The album is fairly consistent, but it does have significant low points and high points. But the sound is more or less consistent. It's just, if you like Fall Out Boy or U2, you'll gravitate towards those songs that kind of in that way, if that makes sense.
So. Yeah. So what songs were low points for you? Do I even want to ask?
The three you mentioned.
Really? Right? Really?
Like, In This Home and Living in Our Memory, is that the title of it?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's that. I didn't dislike it. I was just like, oh, okay. And I just listened to it twice. I was like, oh, that's okay.
Oh, well, you know what? Well, then my least favorite tracks are the ones you liked. I mean, well, if we're going to play that game.
This one I like. Yeah.
No, I didn't really have any songs that I disliked. And that, I think that's what I mean by consistency. Even on albums that I really, really like, there's going to be one or two songs that I just really don't. Even big names that we're like historically fans of, Lecrae's Gravity, Swoop's album Wake Up, like those kind of albums. Although Swoop is actually a near perfect album. But even like on Gravity or Church Clothes, for instance, like there are tracks on those albums that I just can't stand. I'm just like, I'm going to skip that song every time it shows up. I'm sorry, like, that's just the way it is. This album, I would listen to front to back. The main problem is it's got to convince me to listen to it again, right? Like, there's nothing that stands out so much that I'm going to be sort of looking to play this album all the time. But if I'm looking for just sort of a decent pop rock, competent artist album, yeah, I can put this on and not have to worry about being ticked that I'm listening to a bad song.
Yeah, and I should qualify, the low points are not, they're not so bad where you actually feel in agony listening to them, you know, I mean, they're not, I should have made that a little more clear, it's by no means, they're no means horrible songs.
Don't hedge your bets, Don't hedge your bets. You can be mean if you want. You can say that they're terrible songs should destroy them.
I've been mean in the past, but think about it, like, even in hindsight, like, the songs weren't that bad. I just didn't like them very much.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's even though the album's consistent, there are those slight sort of style differences between the different tracks. And so, like you said earlier, like, you're going to gravitate towards the ones that sound like the bands you already like for the most part. That said, they're clearly talented guys. Maybe not the most innovative, but they know what they're doing. And this is, I mean, they're apparently, like, putting out albums quickly. This is their third album in 3 years, which is just kind of nuts. I'd love to see what would happen if they were maybe slowing down and working with some of the bigger names in their genre. That would be really interesting to see what they could pull off.
Yeah, if they did a song with Lecrae, that'd be awesome.
I would just love to see, like, Gunger produce their album or something. That would be nuts.
Yeah, that's the issue with any, like, pop rock, more worship-oriented music, is that from this point on, it's going to live in the shadow of Gunger. So I don't know. Yeah, that's kind of how it's going to have to be from now on, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, and my issue, so sort of my genre issue with pop rock, and that's not to say that I didn't treat this album fairly, but for me, pop rock always kind of felt like it was the middle ground. And it is, right? Like, it's somewhere between pop and rock. But most of the time, I'd rather just listen to pop or just listen to rock, if I have the choice. I would even rather stick on, like, the latest pop song, just because at least it, to me, feels like it's all the way there. Whereas pop rock albums often feel like they're only halfway. So.
Yeah, I prefer chocolate ice cream on its own, vanilla ice cream on its own. I don't put it next.
Fair enough. Well, let's go ahead and wrap this album up real quick. I'll go first. This is Luminate's, looks like their third album. It's called Welcome to Daylight. Came out late 2012. And it's 11 tracks, and it's consistent. It's solid. All the way through, you're going to get roughly the same sound. Pick a song, any song, listen to it. If you think it's at all decent, check out the album. It's worth a listen. If you're looking for more music to stick in your collection that you're not going to be mad about when it comes up on shuffle, or just something you want to stick on the background for an hour, and maybe engage in it occasionally, because it is worth engaging, this is worth picking up. This is worth listening to. That said, it doesn't innovate. It doesn't do anything particularly new in the genre. It doesn't even particularly push the standards of what's great without changing the standards. So, I'm going to have to give it a 3 out of 5.
I think I learned more or less just everything you just said. It's not particularly innovative. It doesn't do anything, for the most part, interesting. But that said, it's not by any stretch bad or incompetent. There's clearly talent there. It's just a matter of, do you like the genre and what do they bring to the genre as new and innovative? I really don't. But that said, it's an innocuous album that you can put on and just kind of listen to. And it's all, yeah, what James said, copy paste.
See, that's why so I had to go first.
I think I would echo that. I think I'll give it 2.5 stars. So that, yeah, I think it's 2.5 stars.
For okay, me. So 2.75 overall. That's not bad.
No, that's actually aggressively about average. But.
See, I had to volunteer to go first this week on doing the end because I knew you were going to say all the same stuff. And I was like, I don't want to just copy Nick.
Oh.
So I stole your thunder this week.
Oh.
And it was fun.
I
believe it. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. The album is Welcome to Daylight. The artist is Illuminate. It's probably available everywhere, I suspect. Certainly on iTunes. And this has been Dual Impressions. I'm James Arnold. Thanks for listening. Nick, say Illuminate's album was pretty good.
Illuminate's album was pretty good.
Hey, there you go. That was something. Thanks, everyone.
From my knees, I've prayed for years. I've once more down on my knees. On my knees. Violently pursue me, God, to the place of the unknown. In my mind and my weary soul, deprived of life, my only hope is in you alone.
Okay, everybody, you have now reached the talk back segment of our podcast, and today I have on the line with me music recording artist Jeremy Vanderloo. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jeremy.
Hey, Calvin, thanks for having me, man.
And for those of you who are listening, I mean, obviously you're listening, people, but Jeremy has released his, I want to say you've released your third studio effort, correct? This is your third album that's just come out, or came out in October. And it's called All Creation Sings. Talk a little bit about, before we talk about the album, though, talk a little bit about who you are, because you were a name who kind of came across my desk, and I was like, who's this guy? Never heard of him before. Popped the CD in. Liked the CD, and then your publicist said, hey, you want to interview? I said, sure. I'd love to talk your ear off. But I didn't know who you are, so I'm going to guess that a lot of our listeners also probably don't know who you are. This is going to be an introduction. So talk a little bit about Jeremy Vanderloo. Who is Jeremy Vanderloo?
Well, I am a 24-year-old guy, almost 25 in April, and I live in Tampa, Florida. I've been playing music full-time for four and a half years. And just been traveling the country for about 3.5 years, doing about 120 shows a year. And just really have a passion to poetically describe my passion for God and for Jesus. And it's just, that's kind of my music aspect and what I've been doing and who I am. And I'm married. I love my wife. She's pretty awesome. She gets to travel with me. And in the industry, I'm known as a new artist. I've only been doing it for 4 years. And it may seem like a long time, but man, it takes a long time sometimes to get people to know who you are. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys and just for the interview. So,
hey, no problem. We're glad that you took the time out of your schedule to do this. Now, okay, you just said that you've been on the road. You've done a number of shows on the road, and you're trying to get people to. I mean, obviously you're a worship leader, but you're also an artist, so you're trying to get people to know who you are. That's just that kind of side of the business. But you just said that your wife travels with you. Kind of unique. I know I've talked to like Jimmy Needham in the past. I'm sure you know that name. And early on in his career, he was also able to travel with his wife, and now they have children, so she's not able to travel as often as far as I understand. So I'm guessing you guys are kind of young married and don't have any kids yet. How's that all work out for you on the road?
We've been married for a little over a year and a half, and she's just, man, she's honestly probably my biggest cheerleader, I guess, is the best way to describe her. She's really passionate, and
honestly, what we do is it's all about connecting with people and really ministering to people. And before we were married, I'd always have young girls and stuff really getting touched by the Lord. And I always kind of kept my distance. And so what she does on the road is she kind of takes these young girls under her wing and just starts discipling them. I mean, they like after we leave, they're always texting her and doing things like that. She helps run my merchandise as well. And so it's just, it's pretty awesome to have her. She's got such a passion for people and for God. And so that's how it works. We are young, we are newlyweds, I guess, apparently a year and a half. So we're still kind of young too, but we have no kids. So I'm sure once we start having kids, she'll probably stay home a little bit more, but it's cool. It's so much fun to have her. I'm blessed, man. So many artists don't get that opportunity to have their wives come with them. And it's just, it's nice. You know, it's nice to have her out on the road with me.
Yeah, so. I imagine so. Now, are you more of a regional artist, or do you get all around the country?
We go all around the country. We're working. I've yet to go to the West Coast. I'm in talks right now with some people in California, so I'm trying to get over that way. But we go as far west as South Dakota, and even sometimes we'll hopefully be hitting up Colorado this year in 2013, and just really all over. So I hit the southeastern region for about 2 years, pretty solid, and now we're pretty much, I guess, half the country that we hit on a regular basis. So it's pretty much all over. But
okay, cool. Now let's talk specifically about the album. Again, this is your third studio album for my introduction to you, and again, I'm going to guess it's going to be your introduction to a lot of people. Talk a little bit about this project. Normally, I'm talking to an artist who I've talked to before. It's like, tell me how this album is different than your last one, because we all loved your last one. But again, you know, hearing this for the first time and never having heard your earlier body of work. So let's talk specifically about this album and its own merits. Talk about the creative process for All Creation Sing. What were you trying to? I know it's worship music, but what were you really trying to communicate with this project? Is there an overarching theme, or are they all kind of standalone worship songs?
Well, the idea behind All Creation Sings is actually, I would say my last two projects were me trying to find myself as an artist, trying to find my niche, my sound, all that stuff. And All Creation Sings is really the beginning of me knowing exactly who I am, the sound that I'm wanting. And I was reading Romans 1:20, where it talks about how all creation is testifying of God's divine nature and glory, how no man has an excuse. And I was in Virginia on tour, and it was the summer of 2011, and God was just like, I want you to do an album called All Creation Sings. And so that August, I started writing, and I went through a process, and I got to sit down with an amazing songwriter that I really enjoy his music. And we were hanging out, and he was like a veteran songwriter. We were just talking, and it really inspired me. And so I started writing and trying to say things in a way that were never said before, and being more descriptive with my lyrics rather than just saying, I love you, God. It would be like, the breath of my soul craves the tender touch of your love, or something like that. You know, just really try to, a lot of reviewers are calling it lyrical imagery. And that's exactly what I was wanting to do, is try to just paint a picture and be super creative and poetic, but really easy to sing in the choruses and touch God's heart with. And that was the goal that we were going after, to just, if I'm connected with the most creative being in the universe, God, who designed everything and created us all and has this amazing, just supreme understanding of everything, and I'm connected with him, then my creativity should just be through the roof as well if I'm spending time with him. And that was the idea, was just to push me to the limit. And I wrote 50 songs for the record, and we ended up having to pick 12. And it was just, you know, it was a fun process. But that was the idea behind it, was to do something new and creative and a little bit more deep and poetic and artistic, but can still easily to kind of grab a hold of God within the choruses. Well,
I like the way that you characterize kind of the passion behind what you're doing, because that kind of speaks to the whole focus of our particular website. I don't know if you've ever been familiar, if it was just kind of like, hey, you want to interview with these guys? Sure, I'll interview with them. But our site is really dedicated to really pushing Christian artists to create better art, and, you know, and to not just be able to get away with, oh, I mentioned Jesus in the song, therefore you have to accept it. It's like, no, you know, we used to be at the forefront of creating great art. And I think for a long time, the worship scene specifically has kind of been very lackluster. I mean, there was Chris Tomlin, and that was great, but then everybody wanted to be Chris Tomlin. And then there was David Crowder, and that was great, but everyone wanted to be David Crowder. And now there's Gunger, and everybody wants to be Gunger, or John Stevens, or Ren Collective. Everybody's trying to sound like everybody else, those four or five guys. So I like that your sound was unique. I knew instantly, hey, this is worship, but it was distinctive. It was unique and different, and I could differentiate it from the Tomlins and the Crowders and the Gungers and those kinds of people. So I really like that you pointed that out, because Christian music and Christian art shouldn't just be given a pass just because Jesus is.
I totally agree with you, man, and I believe it's shifting, because you do have the Gungers and the John Marks and those type of guys that are coming up and pushing like major creativity. And it was just, unfortunately, what I was noticing in the Christian music scene was that we were almost like a decade behind even what the world was doing and what mainstream music was. I hate classifying it the world, and because it kind of brings a separation with us and humanity when we're just saved by grace, and people just haven't realized that yet, you know,
right. In
mainstream. And so that's kind of, I don't know if that makes sense or not, but I had the same focus and said, you know, this is just kind of cheesy stuff. No offense to some other artists, but some of the writing just wasn't complex. If we're trying to describe the most creative being in the universe, let's try to put a little bit more effort in our lyrics and effort with that description to God. And that was, you know, I know a lot of people love the really simple stuff, and I've got friends that write that, and I just, you know, that's kind of where I was coming from. And I really, I took inspiration from Gunger and a lot of those guys. I even started listening to some more mainstream stuff to kind of see, you know, just to admire the art, because everything good comes from the Father, you know, and just admiring the art behind what these people were trying to express, even in mainstream non-Christian markets. And that was kind of how I really pushed through All Creation Sings, I guess.
Yeah, and I think you came out with a really, really, really good piece of art here. I mean, I want to say you came out with a really good product. I mean, obviously it's being sold, but I think you came out with a really, really nice, unique piece of art, which I think is is necessary in the Christian world. Now let's talk about your lyrics. I mean, you're the primary songwriter. I think you wrote all the songs on this album, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I didn't have any co-write. I'm going to start co-writing this next year, but all the songs are just written by me. So.
Now that to me is kind of a feat in this day and age, because you're a worship artist and not the quote-unquote singer-songwriter. And so, you know, normally when I read a worship song, it's like Louis Giglio and like 80 other people wrote this song. So it's really unique to have a worship artist who has written all the lyrics on their album. Talk a little bit about, pick two songs off of the album. I know this is going to say, like, pick your favorite kid. Well, you don't have any kids, but, you know, when you do, don't have a favorite. Let's just, don't do that. It's bad.
Yeah.
But pick a couple of songs off the album that you're particularly happy with, or that has kind of had more of an impact than you might have thought when you were first initially writing it.
Oh, man, that's actually really good. The first one that definitely took me by surprise, I had no clue it was going to have the impact that it's having with the listeners and the audience. It was a song called Beautiful. And that's, I think, it's the third track on All Creation Things. And when I was writing that, what was happening was the last week of tracking, and there was a song, I was in the vocal booth. We had all sorts of other stuff tracked on this song already, and I was in the vocal booth, and it just wasn't clicking with me anymore. And I remember my producer's face when I stepped outside the vocal booth and said, we got to cut this song, and I'm going to write another one this week, and we're going to record the one I write this week. And he was just like, are you sure you can do that? And so we cut the song and produced our face, and we just cut it. And I kind of sat down and wrote about two or three songs. And Beautiful was the second song that just came out. And instantly I played it for my producer, and he was like, whoa, that's crazy. And it was just this raw passion. And so we decided to actually track it in my living room, 100% live, just one take. And it was me and my producer was on cello, and my good friend Jonathan Thomas was doing a kick drum and singing harmonies. Jonathan Thomas plays for a band called Ascend the Hill. I don't know if you're familiar with them or not, but they're great guys too.
Yeah, I found out about them through Relevant Magazine. They did a video with them in studio a while ago. I really like their music.
Yeah, we're from the same city, so we're pretty good friends. They live in Tampa.
Okay, cool.
As well. Yeah. But so that's kind of how Beautiful came about. And it was just really, well, that is just describing the gospel, you know, and the first verse is in the night of the weary light, we knew of a death so sweet that we would believe in you. It was just talking about Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, which where he was, I think I said that right, where he was sitting there weeping. He's the weary light of the world. You know, he was getting weary because of the crucifixion that was coming. But his death was so sweet that we would believe in him, you know, and that was, and the chorus is just, we are free, dead no more, sitting in your arms, living in your love. It's so simple, but yet profound gospel, you know, and that was kind of how really what I wanted to do was describe what the action of Christ in that song and really what it did for us and the benefit to us. So that was the first one.
Okay.
And you said two, right? Two songs.
Yeah, pick another one.
Man, this is always hard. You guys always do this to me. I'll just put a personal one that I really, well, I don't know, this is always hard. The struggle. The struggle kind of came out of the works, too, that I wasn't expecting people to really enjoy that. And that was track six. And that song was just really talking about the struggle between our flesh and our spirit, just the human nature versus the divine God nature dwelling in us through Christ. And it's just really describing that and describing how our flesh is like an assassin to our faith, that we're trying to battle it every day. And the chorus was just victory, you know, basically that sin reigned no more, that it was actually crucified and buried with the grave, that Christ showed it how it was done and just destroyed, you know, hell, death, and the grave, and ultimately redeemed us through his sacrifice. But it was just, you know, when I was writing that song, I remember the confirmation that was supposed to be on the record. A guy called me that actually led me to the Lord, that introduced me to Christ. And he called me, and he was like, I hadn't talked to him in 8 years, probably 7 or 8 years. And he was like, hey, man, I just needed to call you. I'm battling. He was addicted to painkillers. And I was like, so here's this dude that inspired me, and he's going through a struggle now in his life. And we were just chatting, and I told him about the song, and it just ministered to him. And so that's kind of, I finished that song, and I knew it had to go on the record because I knew people could relate to it. But that was actually the free song giveaway that we did for a lot of sites and stuff like that. And it was just, that one kind of, you know, a lot of people enjoy that one as well. It's the longest song on the record, so I wasn't sure if people were going to take it because it was so long. But it's going pretty good, though. So.
Okay, cool. Thanks so much for sharing that. I want to close out with one more question, though. This is more than just music for you. Obviously, there's ministry, but it's allowed you to be involved with different causes, one of which is a Mission of Mercy. Can you talk a little bit about Mission of Mercy and how you're involved in and what they're all about?
Yeah, Mission of Mercy is actually now called One Child Matters. They just changed their name in October. But we kind of connected in October of 2011, and I lived in Mozambique, Africa when I was 18. I lived with 300 orphans. And I've always had a passion to help orphans and needy children and widows and stuff like that through my music. And we finally partnered together, me and One Child Matters, and just really because of my passion for kids and my wife's passion for kids, we just kind of took it by storm, and we've helped probably about 130 to 140 kids so far. And it's just been an amazing opportunity to really help these kids that have nothing. And it's a sponsorship program where people here in the state sponsor kids, very, very similar to Compassion and World Vision. And I always say there's no competition within these organizations. There's so much need out there, and we're all doing so
right.
much, for, you know, right. They flew me and my wife to Mozambique, this past August. And it was just mind blowing what they're really doing, the impact they're having on these lives. It's a great organization. I would definitely encourage you to go check it out at their website, which is onechildmatters.org and all that stuff. It's amazing to be a part of it.
Okay, cool. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for taking the time to hop on the line and share a little bit about who you are and your music and what you're involved in and what it all means to you. We live in a very socially networked world, so why don't you tell our listeners where they can find out more about you and where they can grab your music online.
Yeah, definitely. I have Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at JER, so Jared Vanderloop, VanderLoop. And we're also on Facebook and all over the web. But you can go to my website, which has all the links, which is myname.com. So it's JeremyVanderloop.com. Just like how it sounds, JeremyVanderLoop. Almost forgot how to spell my name. But so that they can get a hold of me through that, and you can actually listen to the whole album for free on my website, and you can purchase it on iTunes and all those nice little places where you can find music.
All right. Well, again, Jeremy, thank you so much for taking the time, and we wish you all the best. And thank you so much for putting out music that is, you know, not only, you know, glorifying to God, but is also artistically expressive. And, you know, I can hand this to my friend and not feel ashamed that it doesn't meet some standard. So thank you for creating great art, too.
Well, thank you for having me, man.
No problem. You have a great afternoon, man.
To bring me to my knees, to wash me clean in